WCRS 98.3 102.1. This is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis, Harvey Wasserman, and Connie Goodell Newton.
That's right. Bob's here with Connie and with Ben. And Ben does many things, including insurgent theater. Why, when things are going so well, Ben, do we need an insurgent theater?
Well, the insurgent theater actually started like 7 years ago in Milwaukee, and it was largely the name was largely came from the theater world, where things are going even more poorly than how well they're going in the regular society. And so we wanted to make a different way of doing a different approach to theater that could change theater's relationship to society.
Uh-huh. Doesn't surprise me, that old Nazi quote, I forget which one, when I hear people talking of culture, I reach for my revolver.
Yes.
So, and this state, they're devastating the arts and the creative community, and a few years back we were leading the nation in outsourcing of 18 to 44-year-olds to other states.
Mm.
And things are looking pretty bleak. A lot of the traditional nonprofits devastated. How is your approach at Insurgent Theater different than sort of holding out your hand to foundations funded by large transnational corporations?
We've never gotten donations more than like a couple hundred dollars, and that's from friends or local businesses and things like that. We do our shows very, very cheaply. We often perform in basements or info shops or all kinds of free spaces, and we keep minimal sets and work with actors who are not professionals, who are kind of learning acting as they go. And it's very much a DIY approach to doing things, and we don't need to be dependent on big money, and it allows us a lot more freedom to find different ways to make things work technically, and also a lot more freedom to make whatever we want because there's no strings attached.
Well, I saw one of your plays, Ulysses Crewman, and that was great. Would you tell us about the
sure.
the plot a little bit? Introduce the the play.
So Ulysses Crewman is it's a two-actor play. It's about kidnapping a group of anarchists who decide to kidnap a delegate to one of the big protests, one of the big global summit sort of protests. The idea is that we've tried blocking the streets to prevent the delegates from getting there, and so this group decides to kidnap the delegates on their way. And something goes terribly wrong, and it ends up just being an examination of this relationship between one of the anarchists and the person who's kidnapped. It's written to mainly raise issues and create a political space in which we can have discussions. And that's why we like to perform in info shops and other informal spaces where we can go from doing the play directly into a conversation about the issues that it brings up.
I noticed that one interesting way that you engaged the audience was having, at least when you came to the info shop in Columbus, the audience was sitting around you in a circle,
mm-hmm.
Which is different from a lot of performance spaces where it's very kind of 2D, and the performers are on a stage up in front of an audience, and the audience is looking at them almost from one perspective. But here you had the performers in the middle and the audience all around you. And so how do you feel about, how does that feel, and what are other ways that you engage the audience?
It's, I really like when I made the decision to present the play in that sort of way, because first of all, it's like immediately accessible. We're on the same level as the audience. They're within a few feet of the actors throughout the entire play, and they're constantly reminded that they are watching a play because they see the other audience members on the other side. And we also have, Kate, one of the actors, the actor who plays the anarchist, reads her stage directions aloud as she's performing. And that's another thing. These are kind of techniques that came from Bertolt Brecht, who's an East German communist kind of a bit too much of a Leninist for my taste, but still he had these really great ideas of how to make theater that keeps people mentally engaged instead of just emotionally passive and watching and absorbing
things. Right, and doesn't it sometimes call attention to the fact that this is a performance?
Mm-hmm.
It really acknowledges that by reading the stage directions. And does she ever actually address the audience?
Yeah, there are a number of ambiguous lines, and there are also lines where it's like directly at the end she directly talks to the audience. But throughout there are ambiguous lines where like she makes eye contact. And
well, did you get the idea about kidnapping from the police kidnapping the demonstrators in Pittsburgh and the other great rallies? I was in Pittsburgh, and the police would literally, I mean, later we thought they were police,
they
but who knows?
Snatch people up.
Yeah, just grab. An activist would be
snatches.
Walking down the street, and some dark black car would roll up and snatch a U.S. citizen.
Yikes.
And, you know, I think they call that extraordinary rendition, or at least rendition, unless they're torturing them. But I'm thinking the great irony of that is that, from my perspective, the police were literally kidnapping people in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, we're going to be doing a benefit show for the RNC 8, who were definitely kidnapped in preemptive arrests, early morning raids with assault rifles drawn. I mean, the play brings up all these issues of like how to confront police power, how to confront state power, and there are lots of people who look at the play and are like, oh, this is violence, this is bad. But the violence that's in this fictional play is dwarfed by the constant violence of the police arresting people and kidnapping people and often with political motivations all the time, every day.
And again, both political parties at their convention with their little free speech zones and virtually
fenced
nobody,
in into a cage.
Yeah,
you can basically go in a cage and then you can say whatever you want to.
Right.
Is that how it works now?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what I saw when I went to the Republican National Convention. And in fact, there was one of the Nation reporters there, and he's in there making a speech, and nobody would go in to listen to him because
nobody wants to be in a cage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the state of our conventional democracy and political forms is completely decrepit. If it was ever worth anything, I don't know. But
so, speaking of not wanting to be in a cage, it seems like anymore the world is made of cages everywhere you look. There's surveillance on the street corners taking pictures of your license plate if you run through a pink light.
Oh, you mean revenue enhancement instruments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And really, right. It's just like the mob. You know, it's like, I've had to pay up. It's in the old days, like if you got drunk and were with a prostitute, you get some pictures saying, pay us. Same thing with the city. When they send those out, it's like, here, we won't report this to your insurance company or make a record of it if you simply pay it. So if you send them the $95, it doesn't go into the public record.
Great.
No due process. It's just the same
extortion.
MO that the mob used.
Yeah, it's blackmail, basically.
Okay, this one's called Thugs in Uniform.
So we have here Police State Funnies, which I definitely got a good laugh about. It seems like last month or in the past couple months since we've been doing this show, I let the listeners know about Critical Mass, which is going to be riding uptown to Battelle, to protest Battelle, and Food Not Bombs is going to provide the food at that event for the hungry activists and any other passersby. So what did you make of that event, Ben?
It was, we had a lot of fun there. I'm largely disenchanted with conventional protest tactics and things like that, but it was in this very, like, the fact that we rode our bikes there and that Food Not Bombs was there with food, it was almost like a very fun sort of atmosphere, And when the Battelle security guards came out, they didn't know what to do with us. And when the cops showed up, they didn't know what to do with us. And it became
great.
This really sort of comedic experience.
They've where got food. We don't know what they're going to do with it. They may feed people.
Exactly.
Let's see. So we have coming out of that event, someone took a bunch of pictures, and it was made into a comic. We have Police State Funnies, Issue 1, in which the police think we don't have this. Block an intersection. Refuse to take candy from a baby. Are afraid of sticks. What's this guy saying?
He's saying, I have a gun.
So.
Well, you picked an interesting target, Battelle, which I have a long relation with. One of the Dirty Dozen radioactive pollution sites in American laboratories. Also, the people that control all the anthrax for the U.S. military, and really an organization that's very shadowy and the CIA's favorite nonprofit testing center. And officially here, if we listen to the corporate for-profit media, you know, just like a fine nonprofit that's helping people. Mm-hmm. Project Jefferson and other activities there were the testing of anthrax, which occurred by Battelle out at West Jeff. But virtually nobody locally knows what this organization is up to. Now, why did you guys target them, and what were you going to do with that food?
I mean, a lot of things that you mentioned are the reasons that we targeted them, and also just the way that they pass everything off as like this nonprofit activity, and they, I think that's the way that the corporations who run our lives so much have gotten very good at making themselves look like the good guys, and very good at like distracting attention into these sorts of charitable things that they do, which is another reason why I hate taking money for doing theater, because too often the arts are those kinds of charities.
Well, there's an old phrase that we used when organized crime got heavily into charities. Mm-hmm. It's Al Capone's soup kitchen. Al Capone actually ran a very elaborate soup kitchen, and part of that was PR. Same thing with a Columbus Foundation, Les Wexner. They also were caught doing the PR to sell the illegal war in Iraq. They were running seminars there, and they said it was a mistake. But a lot of times it's really a way to co-op non-commercial, non-profit sources by handing out large grants and making them dependent. And then twisting those forces we're supposed to trust because they're not commercial to their need. My favorite is the American Cancer Society. Now, virtually every scientist will say 90% of the cancer is caused by chemicals, the petrochemical industry, but they like to stress lifestyle, you know, sort of smoking and you need to exercise more. Even though they know that's 10% of it, that's what they emphasize as the petroleum industry, the chemical industry, and the people that actually cause the cancer sit on their boards and make major donations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get really upset at all of the research for cancer, find a cure for cancer campaigns, because it seems like, you know, I'm sure Battelle had a big team in Pelotonia where it costs $1,000 to ride your bike to give it for cancer research. And I know that, you know, there are a lot of people who are doing that bike ride in earnest and really think that they're doing a good thing for people who've been hit with a horrible disease. But I guess where my kind of suspicion comes in, or my misgivings, are that I feel like it gives corporations a chance to kind of get off the hook for the environmental damage that they may be causing that causes cancer. I think prevention is very important. It's priceless, because if you cannot get cancer in the first place, then you don't need a cure for cancer. And, you know, I think it's possible with all the research that's being done, burning carcasses of animals that have been experimented on, and that that waste goes into the air or it goes into the water. Battelle's right on the river, you know, and so I think there's a danger of waste going into the water supply from there and from chemical lawn treatments that people use. Scott's Miracle-Gro is sponsoring a lot of community gardens in Columbus right now. And, you know, I think that there's a real danger.
That's the miracle growth of the tumors.
Yeah, it makes them really grow. And so, I mean, I think there are a lot of legitimate concerns about the damage that these corporations who are pretending, well, or maybe trying to do something good for, you know, people with a certain medical condition. I think that, you know, we know what causes cancer, and maybe, you know, it seems like it would be good to not cause it and not to support those companies that do cause it and not allow them to get off the hook for finding some cure for something that could have been prevented in the first place. It's kind of like how, you know, we're letting Diebold fix the election theft problem by supplying the counties, the boards of elections, with more faulty machines that are still probably susceptible to being hacked and programmed with votes for one political party or the other.
Well, the operative word there was fix.
Yeah, fixing the machine, fixing the vote. You know, I think that corporations have a vested interest in making people feel as if they're dependent on them for a cure, for something, for a food supply, for whatever it is. I think that's very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. If we all fed ourselves and didn't get sick, we wouldn't need corporations for a lot of things. And they wouldn't have a reason to exist.
Well, the police state funnies, in part, they're funny because they seem to be actually occurring events.
Yeah. And it's, like, pretty truthful if you look at them. You know, it's like the cops are so concerned about activists with posters with sticks. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you have guns, you know? I'm actually not armed. I'm more afraid of you, sir.
Right.
You know, so...
And that is a conversation I had with police on the lawn. And the interesting thing about that one is the way the number of people who were among the activist organizers of that protest who saw me with a stick and came and tried to police me before the police even had to.
Right.
Which was... I was surprised by that experience.
Right. Yeah, it looks, the comic is interesting, I think, because it brings up issues that activists face, you know. How do we plan a protest that is going to be legal, where we're not going to be harassed or, you know, somehow provoke the police in some way?
Hmm.
Because they can be very dangerous. They are armed and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them, I'm sure, have PTSD because their jobs are difficult jobs, and they have trauma in their jobs, and then they take that trauma and put it back out on people.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think the police are very dangerous for activists, and that it can be walking a fine line when you're an activist trying to plan a protest. But then also, you bring up the issue of, you know, about what happens when activists have different tactics. And, you know, that's definitely a theme that has come up with Peter Gelderloos.
Yeah.
You know, he was talking about differences between nonviolent pacifist protesters who insist on nonviolence as opposed to people who may have other tactics, you know, that run the gamut, you know, the spectrum of violence to nonviolence or self-defense.
Yeah, from direct action to more confrontational forms of direct action to illegalism. I mean, it's clear that standing somewhere and holding a sign is not going to impact the political system anymore. I mean, any the free speech zones that you described, they're like these cages. The places where we have access to the public dialogue are becoming increasingly controlled and limited, and it's at some point we need to find a way to break those open. And it's at one of the protests in there, that was a immigration rally, and they had signs that said no one is illegal, and I had a sign on a stick that said everyone is illegal, because the only life that we can live in a completely legal life in our society,
it's impossible. It's really a fine line.
Is totally too contradictory. Passive and neutral.
You're in a double bind.
Yeah. And so like we do need to find ways to make change and to make more confrontational forms of this, and it's going to be these are all very difficult challenges, and I think that's another reason that the RNC 8 is important to me, and that we're doing a solidarity show for them.
And a lot of what's happening, having lived through it, it's really hard to believe how open this country was in the 70s, in the aftermath of the, I consider a people's victory to help in the Vietnam War. But really, you had the reaction. I mean, in many ways, the corporatists, although I prefer Mussolini's term, the fascist reaction, which drugged their junior partners with them, the Democratic Party in the 1980s, in order to be competitive, really has changed society. Number one, we're the largest spy apparatus ever recorded. I mean, we passed the East German Stasi. $50 billion, 80% of it spent spying on our own citizens without probable cause. We don't like to talk about that. The tripling of the prison industrial complex in 8 years and really no resistance. The fact that 25% of all the prisoners on planet Earth are locked up in the United States with 4% of the world's population. Massive, you know, security industrial complex, prison industrial complex, military industrial complex. 1.4 million innocent Iraqi civilians killed as a result of an illegal war. And there's really no public debate of these issues. The ability of the for-profit media, and really about six of them, the infotainment companies like Disney and NBC and the blatant propaganda arms like Fox, have really reined in the society. So obviously you've been thinking, what do we do to bust it open, to have basic dialogue? Because any attempt to have any realistic dialogue doesn't occur.
Mm-hmm. And even if it did, it would be within that environment, that sort of echo chamber of the mainstream media. And to cite an example that Peter Gelderloos talked about when he was in town, in Greece, he spent time in Greece when the like insurrection things were going on back in 2008, and he talked about them breaking into and taking over a television station, but they did not try to talk. They just held up a sign that said, I believe the sign said something like, "Get off, turn off your television, and get in the street." And they very intentionally did not want to go and speak and participate in the infotainment spectacle machine that is the media.
That's pretty interesting.
Well, because you have questions of media literacy, you've got certain styles, which this show isn't one of them, but there's certain parameters and limits if you want to be taken seriously.
Right.
And even with the oppositional forces, they took hip-hop, which was indigenous and anti-gang violence and spontaneous, and have turned it into for-profit gangster rap, which supports gang violence. And anyone who comes up with a systemic analysis like Chuck D is thought to be crazy.
I think with the rap. The combination of the police state and the mainstream media really creates a coercive environment for that kind of dialogue you're talking about. You know, we want to have an open dialogue about the role of the state and the police state and police brutality. All right, just to quickly change the subject, I'll give a station ID. And I have a letter from a friend. This is WCRS 98.3 102.1. This is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton. In the studio, we have Ben from Insurgent Theater. And for immediate release, Wednesday, August 4th, 2010, from Chris, the anarchist Ryan, 60 weeks till my jam date. So Chris will be out in hopefully a year, September maybe. Okay. For The Hemp Rock Radio Network, from behind the wall. Commentary on life as a prisoner of pot by Chris the Anarchist Ryan. An unexpected thing about prison is how it teaches appreciation for simple things. A good workout unloading a hot, sweaty truck full of frozen food. A sweet, cooling breeze in the truck's shadow afterwards. An attractive person smiling and waving at you. A long, cold drink of water on a hot, humid day. Things taken for granted or belittled outside become tokens of liberty. Remember how Tom Sawyer convinced some boys to help whitewash a fence? In prison, people do stuff they would ordinarily spurn to get outside for a change of routine. It's like whitewashing Aunt Polly's fence. When an opportunity to hop onto a supply truck bound for another prison a couple miles away comes, just to unload the truck, it's a welcome change of pace. After all, it takes a special fella to whitewash a fence, or survive as a prisoner of pot. By Chris the Anarchist Ryan, on Wednesday, August 4th, 2010.
Well, you know, he was dealing there with a weed that grows naturally, and nothing the big farmies hate worse than naturally grown drugs. It's particularly since they've got the market on their own synthetic heroin.
Which one is that, do you know?
Oxycontin.
Oh.
It's the dream come true.
Yeah.
So it's really ironic.
Pills.
And this is where, my libertarian friends I agree with. One of the few things are good on there. The drug war. It's sort of like the drug war. If you look at that whole history going back to Mussolini in the 1920s, I mean, he was, which Hearst borrowed in going after marijuana here, is you need an endless war. And there's nothing that's easier than going after eradicating weed that occurs naturally. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're always going to have it out there. And it also raises the price so the people that are connected and protected by the government can make huge profits. So friends of the CIA can make a ton of money off.
Because if it was just growing in your backyard like mint, I mean, you can also buy
Jefferson's backyard. It grew in Jefferson's backyard.
You can buy peppermint for $5 a box at the store, so you're still paying something for it, but you can also grow it for free in your backyard.
True enough. So why do people put up with this, Ben?
Because there's a giant police state that forces them to.
They're not really putting up with it so much.
But I thought those police were there to protect us from them.
You mean as white rich people?
Whoever, I know, us as, white people or people with money, and them is whoever them happens to be.
Whoever it happens to be at the
right,
moment.
Right, I mean, them, so. You know, the Hispanics are them now, but the Hispanics were the ones that, you know, we're providing cheap labor so we could have cheap food when the economy was going a little better. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, it seems like the police state definitely creates a myth of, a dangerous criminal other that makes people who are in power.
But the police themselves know there's another. Ben. What's the last word, Ben? Okay. Tell us.
The last word?
Are you an enemy of the state? Are you a threat to decency?
The state seems to consider all of us enemies.
There you have it.
This has
been Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton.
Hanging out with an insurgent.
Insurgent Ben.
Peace.
Peace.
Thank you.